The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Today on the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, the FBI goes under the microscope.
February and March of 2016, Peter Strzok said, Trump's abysmal. Trump's an idiot. He's a bleeping idiot. Hillary should win 100 million to zero. Sounds to me like he hates the president.
We'll look at the actions of former FBI Director James Comey.
I think what he was trying to do here was get out of this situation with the FBI's reputation intact. And by doing it the way he did it, he achieved exactly the opposite.
President Trump responds to the crisis at the border.
We're looking to keep families together. It's very important.
Republicans have a long-term plan. But first, they had to deal with the Democrats.
What the Democrats are proposing is their most radical, open borders, lawless proposal yet.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. When the week began, it was all about the Inspector General's report on the FBI. By midweek, the entire planet was talking about children of immigrants at the border being separated from their parents. By the end of the week, solutions to the latter, hearings on the former. Just another fast-moving news cycle in the Donald Trump era. We'll start with the Inspector General's report, which found gross bias deep within an agency that American citizens expect to protect their interests at all costs. Clearly, the hierarchy of the former FBI had let us down. Here's my reaction after the 568-page report landed. It is clear that if what is now known because of the Inspector General report was known prior to the election, President Trump would have won by an even greater margin in the Electoral College and perhaps the popular vote. The report is that damning. There is an October surprise revealed in the Inspector General report, most of which is that the Bureau tried to sit on what they discovered on Anthony Weiner's laptop. Third, there was an extensive PR campaign, including the briefing of all former FBI agents they could reach on how to spin this. But fourth and most damning, the second lead, the intrusion analysis on Secretary Clinton's server, shows indeed there was at least one compromise of the server that was discovered. And there is a conclusion that sophisticated foreign adversaries could cover their tracks in and out of the server, and that the draft of the report by former FBI Director Comey, the first draft went from concluding that it was, quote, reasonably likely that hostile actors had invaded the server, to the final draft that it was possible. Many other people are focusing on the many and obvious professional collapses of the, quote, mid-year team, close quote, when it came to technique and ethics. I remain focused on the fact that the server had to have been compromised, and all the recovered and missing emails from that server are in the possession of hostile powers, and we still don't have a damage assessment of what the unsecured server did to everyone else connected to it. Given the limits imposed on the Inspector General, the blinders put on by law and by design, we will never know. It's a damning report, but it doesn't help the country fix the damage at all. Take a look at footnote 75. FBI analysts and prosecutor, too, told us that former President Barack Obama was one of the 13 individuals with whom Clinton had direct contact using her ClintonEmail.com account. Then begin to consider hostile actors lurking on the server. Undetected, not possible of detection. And imagine, just imagine what they saw and with what they saw what they did. Now, there's many other things, but I'm going to read to you the go-to by Kim Strassel. Kim Strassel has, first of all, a Twitter thread that reads this way. Don't believe anyone who claims Horowitz didn't find bias. He very carefully says he found no documentary evidence that bias produced, quote, specific investigatory decision. That's different Right, Strassel. It means he didn't catch anyone doing anything so dumb as writing down that they took a specific step to aid a candidate. You know, like, quote, let's give out this Combetta immunity deal so nothing comes of that that will derail Hillary for the president. But in fact, Kimberly Strassel continues, he finds bias everywhere. The examples are shocking and concerning, and he devotes entire sections to them. And he very specifically says in the summary that they, quote, cast a cloud, close quote, on the entire, quote, investigation's credibility. That's pretty damning. Meanwhile, continues Strassel, the same cast of characters who the IG has now found to have made a hash of the Clinton investigation and who demonstrate such bias seamlessly move to the Trump investigation. And we're supposed to think they got this one right? She continues, also don't believe anyone who says this is just about Comey and his instances of insubordination, though they are bad enough. This is an indictment broadly of an FBI culture that believes itself above the rules it imposes on others. People failing to adhere to their recusals, Kadzik, McCabe, Lynch hanging with Bill, staff helping Comey conceal details of pressure from DOJ bosses, use of personal email and laptops, leaks, accepting gifts from media, agent affairs, relationships. She continues, it also contains stunning examples of incompetence. Comey explains that he wasn't aware the Wiener laptop was a big deal because he didn't know Wiener was married to Huma Abedin. Then they sit on it a month, either because it fell through the cracks, wow, or were more obsessed with Trump. She concludes, and I can still hear the echo of the howls from when Trump fired Comey. Still waiting to hear the apologies now that this report has backstopped the Rosenstein memo and the obvious grounds for his dismissal. Andrew McCarthy is the former chief assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, regularly writes on legal matters. He's also a longtime friend of James Comey, who did not fare well in the inspector general's report. McCarthy spoke with Salem host Michael Medved.
What is clear in the IG's report is this is not equivocal in terms of its criticism and devastation of the reputation, whatever remained of James Comey, right?
Well, yeah, I think that especially for kind of inside FBI, it really does slam him pretty hard. I mean, I must say when I first read it, Michael, I thought as hard as this is on Comey, how much is the public really going to care about it? And what I mean by that is, what he gets mainly thrashed for is overstepping his boundaries as FBI director and usurping the authority of the executive branch. And then there's some shady behavior where he really goes out of his way not to notify them about what he's up to, mainly because he knows if he tells them what his intentions are with respect to having this infamous July 5th press conference, that they will tell him not to do it. So there's sort of sneaky stuff in there, and it's not admirable in any way, but it's really mainly about FBI, DOJ lines of authority and overstepping them. And I don't have a good sense of how much people care about that. I know the president has made a big deal out of it, and therefore the people who are reliably in the president's corner are kind of echoing that critique, but I just wonder how much other people care about it.
Well, I'll tell you what I care about, and this is one of the great mysteries here. We were talking about it as if it were a novel before. What was Comey's motivation? I mean, one of the things that the IG report makes very, very clear is he had no permission. He had no authorization. This was completely unprecedented. It threw all the norms and all the normal rules into the trash heap. For him to go and do this press conference announcing a decision that wasn't even his decision to make, and at the same time that he was trashing somebody, in this case Hillary Clinton, who he had decided not to prosecute, what do you think he was trying to do? Why did he do this?
Well, I like to think, and this is the best spin I can put on it. I don't like the word spin because I really do think that there's something to this. But, you know, just for in the interest of full disclosure, Comey's been a friend of mine. I haven't had much contact with him in recent years, but, you know, I've known him for 30 years. I've always admired him. I never had anything but a kind word for him and felt that reciprocally. So take that for what it's worth. I think what he was trying to do here was get out of this situation with the FBI's reputation intact And by doing it the way he did it, he achieved exactly the opposite of what he hoped to achieve. I think that what he wanted to convince the public was that, notwithstanding the fact that he was in a situation where there was no way on God's green earth that the Obama administration, the Obama Justice Department, was ever, ever going to charge Hillary Clinton, he wanted to demonstrate that the FBI had done a thorough, credible investigation and had not been part of a whitewash, even though it was necessarily part of a whitewash. So the way he tried to square that circle, and I think this was tragically wrong, was to not only go along with the plot or the plan of not charging her, but take it on himself to be the person in government who was who that decision was most embodied in, because he decided that Attorney General Lynch was no longer viable after her meeting with President Clinton. And then he went out there and did something you should never do as a government official, as a Justice Department official, FBI official, and that is talk about the evidence in a case where a person is not charged. So that, I mean, basically the rules of the road are the government speaks in court. So you keep your big mouth shut until you have a case that you're ready to indict, and then you formally bring it so that the person that you accuse has all the due process protections they're supposed to have. And what he did here was ostensibly exonerate her, but lay out all the proof against her. And I think the idea behind that was to show that that despite the decision that got made, the FBI really did do a very thorough investigation.
Am I right here, Andrew, that part of the IG report actually echoes exactly what, in much better writing, Rod Rosenstein wrote to the president? When Rod Rosenstein was first appointed deputy attorney general, President Trump asked him to prepare a letter evaluating the way Comey had performed on this matter, the Hillary Clinton investigation. And Rosenstein wrote a letter saying, whoa, this is wildly inappropriate. And that seems to be the conclusion Michael Horowitz has reached, the inspector general as well, no?
Yes, I think that's right. And I think Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein in that particular, I think pretty tartly noted that we had a very divided political culture in Washington and throughout the country. But the one thing that seemed to unify all the ideologies and all the parties was that Comey was completely wrong. the one thing that everybody could come together on was that he had blatantly violated the rules about commenting on investigations and commenting on uncharged people.
Go to townhallreview.com for the rest of the conversation. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
What the Democrats are proposing is their most radical, open borders, lawless proposal yet.
Senator Tom Cotton when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. For decades, most of those crossing the border illegally were single males. But that has changed. More and more, we are seeing families attempt to make the long, very difficult, often dangerous journey. As the Trump administration seeks to stem the tide of illegal immigration, they began a strict enforcement of a policy that detains the parents and place children in temporary holding facilities. Understandably, this caused a great uproar nationwide and shifted news coverage away from the IG report to the border. In Congress and at the White House, politicians knew something had to change, and fast. Midweek, Donald Trump signed an executive order allowing families to stay together as they awaited adjudication of their claims to stay in the country or deportation. Senator Ted Cruz introduced a long-term answer that gained a lot of support. Democrats put forward their own bill, but that was a disaster in the making. I spoke with Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas prior to the Trump executive order at a time when tensions were extremely high. this is an unwinnable issue, and I don't want to talk about straw men's. I just want to talk about Ted Cruz is going to bring a bill to the Senate floor to double the number of immigration judges, expand the number of detention centers, by the way, which would allow fencing around those detention centers, which can be placed near the border, and to expedite the processing of asylum claims so that we can also keep children together with parents during their period of detention. Will you support the Cruz bill?
Hugh, I haven't seen Ted's bill yet. I can say this, though. What the Democrats are proposing is their most radical open borders, lawless proposal yet. Let's just call a spade, Hugh. 49 Democrats have now supported a bill by Dianne Feinstein that says children at the border are literally a get-out-of-jail-free card. If you show up at our border, you have to be released into our country, never to be seen again. They are literally a get-out-of-jail-free card and a get-into-the-U.S.-free card. Moreover, Hugh, let's look at this from another angle. All across America, there are parents who are separated from their children because they have been arrested for a crime or they've been convicted of a crime. And their children are placed with the next of kin or their children are placed in foster care. That probably happened last night in Arkansas multiple times. Yet the Democrats aren't crying for those American citizens. They're willing to treat illegal immigrant criminals better than they treat American citizens who are charged with a crime. So what they are proposing shows just how radical and extreme the Democrats have become on immigration. Hugh, there's a very simple solution to this. I am working with many senators to get this solution on the spending bill we're considering this week. The Trump administration's hands are tied by liberal judges and Democrats who have ruled over the years that children at the border can't be detained for more than 20 days. That's why when their parents bring them to their border or, just as likely, kidnap them or buy them from human traffickers to pose as parents at the border, the parent is taken into custody. The child can't be detained for more than 20 days and therefore placed with a relative or placed in a kind of foster care. All we need to do, Hugh, is overturn the so-called Flores settlement, allow families to be held at the border, provide a little bit of extra money to the military and DHS for family housing units while those claims are adjudicated. We're going to offer amendment this week on the spending bill. It can be done promptly, but it'll expose the Democrats for what they are, advocates of totally open borders, because they don't want families held together at the border. This is not about family separation for the Democrats. This is about an open border policy that lets children be a get-out-of-jail-free card and a get-into-the-U.S.-free card. I don't think many Americans support that policy.
But allowing families to stay together at the border is the solution, not releasing them.
Of course not. But Hugh, that's not the Democrats' solution. The simple solution that most Americans would like to see is that when an illegal immigrant shows up and tries to cross our border illegally with a child, that family unit is held together at the border while the illegal immigrant's claim is promptly processed, which happens in a matter of days or weeks, Hugh. And in most cases, they're going to be sent back to their country, and that's where the family can be reunified.
I get that, but the political argument right now, as is playing out on TV screens on the Today Show and across the media, is devastating to Republicans because it isn't about keeping families together during adjudication. It's about separating them during adjudication, and that's got to change or the consequences will be devastating in the fall. Agree or disagree, Senator Cotton?
Well, I would simply encourage all of my Republican colleagues to expose the Democrats' position for the fraud it is and the extreme radical open borders position that it is. Again, we can easily fix this problem by allowing DHS to hold family units together at the border. That's not what the Democrats want. They want totally open borders.
When the story on the children of immigrants broke and quickly grew into the hottest topic in the news cycle, many reporters, understandably, covered the human side of the story. Over at the National Review, Rich Lowry attempted to explain the facts that led to the complicated situation. Here's Salem host Mike Gallagher.
Rich Lowry writes of the definitive piece on this. I mean, he says, as usual, the outrage obscures more than it illuminates. So it's worth walking through what's happening. For the longest time, illegal immigration was driven by single males from Mexico. Over the last decade, the flow has shifted to women, children, and family units from Central America. This poses challenges we haven't confronted before. These are very big challenges. The Trump administration isn't changing the rules that pertain to separating an adult from a child. Those remain the same. Separation happens only if officials find that the adult is falsely claiming to be the child's parent, or is a threat to the child, or is put into criminal proceedings. And it's the last thing that is operative here. The past practice had been to give a free pass to an adult who is part of a family unit. The new Trump policy is to prosecute all adults. The idea is to send a signal that we're serious about our laws and to create a deterrent against reentry. When a migrant is prosecuted, he or she is taken into custody by the marshals. In no circumstance anywhere in the U.S. do the marshals care for the children of people they take into custody? The child's taken into the custody of HHS, who cares for them at temporary shelters. The criminal proceedings are exceptionally short, assuming there's no aggravating factors such as prior illegal entity or another crime. The migrants generally plead guilty. They're then sentenced to time served, typically all in one day. After this, they're returned to the custody of ICE. The adult then wants to go home. It's relatively simple. The adult should be reunited quickly with his or her child or children. The family returns home as a unit. Now, where this becomes more of an issue is if the adult files an asylum claim. In that scenario, the adults are almost certainly going to be detained longer than the government is allowed to hold the children. That's because of something called the Flores Consent Decree from 1997. It says that unaccompanied children can be held only 20 days. A ruling by the Ninth Circuit extended the 20-day limit to children who come as part of family units. So even if we want to hold a family unit together, we're forbidden from doing so. So you have the choice of either releasing the adults and children together into the United States. If the adult is held, HHS places the child with a responsible party in the U.S., ideally a relative. Even if Flores didn't exist, the government would be very constrained in how many family units it can accommodate. ICE has about 3,000 family spaces in the shelters. So he says a couple points about this. Family units can go home quickly together. That's an option that both honors our laws and keeps family units together. A swift return home after they're prosecuted. Two, there's a better way to claim asylum. Three, there's a significant moral cost to not enforcing the border. Very important point that the liberals and the Democrats and the open border advocates never acknowledge. There is a significant moral cost to not enforcing the border. Needless to say, children should not be making this journey that is fraught with peril. Congress can change the rules so the Flores Consent Decree will no longer apply, and it can appropriate more money for family shelters at the border. This is an obvious thing to do that would eliminate the tension between enforcing our laws and keeping family units together. The Trump administration is throwing as many resources as it can at the border to expedite the process. It desperately wants the Flores Consent Decree reversed, despite some mixed messages, he says. If the administration had its druthers, family units would be kept together and their cases settled quickly. The missing piece here is Congress.
I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up, how did past politicians handle illegal immigrants?
It is wrong and ultimately self-defeating for a nation of immigrants to permit the kind of abuse of our immigration laws we have seen in recent years, and we must do more to stop it.
The Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Listening to the rhetoric of politicians on immigration, you might get the impression that the Democrats and the Republicans are miles apart. But what Republicans say today, Democrats said just a few years ago, including, as you'll hear, former President Bill Clinton. Larry Elder's crew assembled a string of tough talk on immigration from both the left and the right.
May I remind you of what Messrs. Bill Clinton, Harry Reid, Barack Obama used to say about illegal immigration?
All Americans, not only in the states most heavily affected, but in every place in this country, are rightly disturbed by the large numbers of illegal aliens entering our country. The jobs they hold might otherwise be held by citizens or legal immigrants. The public service they use impose burdens on our taxpayers.
We have to listen to the concerns that working people, our forgotten working people, have over the record pace of immigration and its impact on their jobs, wages, housing, schools, tax bills, and general living conditions. These are valid concerns expressed by decent and patriotic citizens from all backgrounds, all over.
If making it easy to be an illegal alien isn't enough, how about offering a reward for being an illegal immigrant? No sane country would do that, right?
We will turn off the jobs and benefits magnet. We will ensure that E-Verify is used to the fullest extent possible under existing law, and we will work with Congress to strengthen and expand its use across the country.
That's why our administration has moved aggressively to secure our borders more, by hiring a record number of new border guards, by deporting twice as many criminal aliens as ever before.
Zero tolerance for criminal aliens. Zero. Zero. Moving forward, we will issue detainers for illegal immigrants who are arrested for any crime whatsoever, and they will be placed into immediate removal proceedings.
We will try to do more to speed the deportation of illegal aliens who are arrested for crimes, to better identify illegal aliens in the workplace, as recommended by the commission headed by former Congresswoman Barbara Jordan.
If you break our laws by entering this country without permission and give birth to a child, we reward that child with U.S. citizenship and guarantee a full access to all public and social services this society provides. And that's a lot of services. Is it any wonder that two-thirds of the babies born at taxpayer expense at country, county-run hospitals in Los Angeles are born to illegal alien mothers?
By cracking down on illegal hiring, by barring welfare benefits to illegal aliens.
Our enforcement priorities will include removing criminals, gang members, security threats, visa overstays, public charges, that is, those relying on public welfare or straining the safety net, along with millions of recent illegal arrivals.
But we are also a nation of laws. It is wrong and ultimately self-defeating for a nation of immigrants to permit the kind of abuse of our immigration laws we have seen in recent years, and we must do more to stop it.
That was then, but now all of a sudden it's racist to enforce the borders.
This is intentional cruelty. It's something that they are doing deliberately. They are making a choice to separate babies from their mothers. They are doing that as an inhumane policy because the people are brown. We also have to talk about the fact that this is a racist policy. If these children were white, we would not be doing this.
Here's what the president said about our immigration laws.
You look at what's happening in Europe. You look at what's happening in other places. We can't allow that to happen to the United States. Not on my watch. For the rest of the world, you look at everything that's taking place, pick up your newspapers this morning, and you see, we want safety and we want security for our country. If the Democrats would sit down instead of obstructing, we could have something done very quickly. Good for the children, good for the country, good for the world. It could take place quickly. We could have an immigration bill. We could have child separation. We're stuck with these horrible laws. They're horrible laws. What's happening is so sad.
And here's what Obama said.
You know, we all agree on the need to better secure the border and to punish employers who choose to hire illegal immigrants.
But now, such a policy, of course, is racist.
It's so sad. And it can be taken care of quickly, beautifully, and we'll have safety. This could really be something very special. It could be something maybe even for the world to watch, just like they're watching our great economy, how it's soaring. We have the worst immigration laws in the entire world.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up, Gina Pastore, wife of former big league player Frank Pastore, tells her story.
Knowing that people are around you, absorbing your pain and grieving and crying with you, it just means the world to the person going through it. So that's really key.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Former Cincinnati Reds pitcher Frank Pastore was a longtime member of the Salem family. He hosted the Afternoon Drive talk show out of Los Angeles. Prior to that, he was my go-to guest host as he cut his chops in talk radio. Good friend. He and my sometimes producer radio blogger is usually reclining, Dwayne, He and Frank would go to baseball games instead of either of them working. He was a really good friend. In 2012, Frank Pastore was killed after his motorcycle was struck by a car on the freeway when he was coming home from work. He was 55. Most of his life and until his death, he was married to Gina Pastore. She has since written the book, Picking Up My Shattered Pieces. Gina Pastore recently spoke with my other friend and colleague, Dennis Prager.
You guys had a love affair. I mean, you...
We did.
Yes.
I met him when I was 11, Dennis. 11. I wasn't hormonal.
I wasn't hormonal yet. I've never heard that phrase. I was hormonal at 3.
You're a guy.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I meet him at 11. He comes in. He's best friends with my brother, Johnny. The guy walked in the house, and I don't know what it was about him, but he just caused me to flip a lid. And he came in. He was commanding. He talked loud. He was gregarious and loving and warm, and it just came across at 15, and it struck this 11-year-old girl. So I developed a crush on him. But we didn't go out till I was turning 15. He asked my dad. He had been signed by the Cincinnati Reds and went off to Billings, Montana to play single A. Came home, and I was now a freshman at All-Girls Catholic High School. And he saw me and went right to my dad and said, can I take Gina on her first date?
So he was 19.
He was 19, yes.
I would, if I were your father, I'd have smacked him on the head.
Well, my dad, he really liked Frank, and he kind of thought it was cute because Frank had become a fixture over at the Italian family, and my parents loved cooking Italian food for him, and he loved to eat, and so they thought he was a charming young man. So at first it was all fine. So they said, yes, he could take me out. We go out on this first date. I'm trying to act sophisticated at 15 because I'm with this 19-year-old baseball player who I have a mad crush on. And he takes me to back then we didn't have the big theaters like we have now, but we went to the Montclair Triplex, and there were three movies. There was Bambi, Shampoo, the movie with Warren Beatty and Julie Christie, and a documentary that I don't remember. And he said, well, I guess we're going to go see Bambi. And I said, I'm trying to act cool. And I said, no, let's go see Shampoo. And he was like a little uncomfortable with that, but that's the movie that we went to see.
So did you date from then on?
We dated a few times after that, but he was conflicted because of my age, and he was leaving to play ball.
Thank God. I just want to say.
So he left to play ball, came back, and the following year, I'm now 16, and he asked me out again, and then we basically were together ever since then.
And at what age did you marry?
I was still 16 when we married. We married the following year after the season. I was just shy.
So, all right, so... I remember his writing and his speaking about, he was not immune to the lure of groupies that follow all major league athletes.
No, he wasn't.
So when did that happen?
Well, as soon as he started playing in the minor leagues, there were groupies at the, the games and stuff like that. So he, as any young male, started dating, and he had...
seeing you?
Yes.
Okay, go on.
Yes, we had dated, and
were you aware?
Yes, he would tell me. He would call during the. This is again before cell phones. He would call every Sunday night after I believe it was 9 o'clock because the rates were cheaper, and he would, tell me what he was doing, and I didn't like hearing it. But I dated a few people too in between there. So we knew that there was this age gap, and we had to deal with it.
Right. What is it like to be a baseball wife?
It is, for me, it was I was very comfortable in it because I'd grown up in a baseball family. My dad lived and breathed baseball. My brother John played baseball with the Oakland A's. He was Frank's catcher all through high school. There were challenges, the long road trips. There's a lot of pressure. People don't understand the pressure on the athlete, especially a pitcher. I mean, you and I talked a little bit about our aches and pains coming in here. I have a bad neck. You just had hip surgery. Imagine being an athlete and you're making a living throwing pitches. A hangnail.
One of the most unnatural acts a human body can engage in.
Exactly, yes. So there's a lot of pressure. And then there are women all over after baseball players. They will do anything to land a baseball player. So you have that pressure going on. So I'm 17 in the big leagues now with Frank, and I knew about his past, and now I'm getting an eyeful. Like, I went on a lot of the road trips in the beginning because I didn't have children yet. So I saw a lot of things happening, and yeah, so it was intimidating.
So what's your reaction to the statement, time heals?
That didn't bother me too much. People say, I think people feel compelled that they have to say something to you, and the truth is they don't.
Right. It just, I'm so sorry.
Yes.
That's
right.
If you're
going to say something, yes, that's a good one.
Well, I mean it, and that's what I tell people. But no, I'm not, it's not the phrase I want your reaction to, the reality. Does time heal?
Yes. In time, you grow to accept what's happened, and you grow accustomed to the new reality. So, yes, it does.
What have been, I assume there's a plural, the biggest helps for you to cope with this loss?
Ah, good question. I think for me, well, the thing that helped me the most, especially in the beginning, was the support and love and people being around. That was really key, like mm-hmm. yourself. And knowing that people are around you, absorbing your pain and grieving and crying with you, it just means the world to the person going through it. So that's really key. I'm a believer in counseling, and I got my butt into grief counseling right away with a Judeo-Christian. That's a caveat. I believe you need to see it.
God-centered.
Yes, yes. That's not somebody who's got wigged out views, you know, but
right.
Yes. So I immediately went back to counseling, and that was enormously, because there is a scientific method to grief. It's a very natural, it's mm-hmm. a soulish thing. And people, you know, honestly, I have found that it's so misunderstood, especially in the evangelical church. It's misunderstood.
For all of Dennis Prager's conversation with Gina Pastore, visit townhallreview.com. I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up.
This isn't much interest to the media because it includes all the wrong sort of people for a hot story with a political hook.
Mike Gallagher with the final segment of the Town Hall Review in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Not every mass shooting in America makes big news. For some, that's a surprise. But there's certain elements that make some stories more attractive to the media than others. Certain stories that are deemed more worthy of media attention. I'll let Mike Gallagher explain.
Jazz Shaw writes a great piece. Every day in Chicago, cities like Chicago, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., we see gang violence, terrible things happening. Did you know that we had a mass shooting over the weekend? I'll bet you didn't. One dead, 22 shot. 22 people shot, including a 13-year-old boy. It took place in Trenton, New Jersey. It was called Art All Night Trenton. New York Times, it was on page A17, says Jazz Shaw over at Hot Air. Wasn't much on the broadcast networks. Gunmen opened fire at an all-night arts and music festival, sending people running over each other in the scramble to safety. One suspect killed by the police. The bad guy, incidentally, the shooter, he had been out of prison on parole for all of 4 months for a previous murder. Nice guy. There were multiple gangs involved. One killed, 22 injured. As Jazz Shaw points out, this isn't much interest to the media because it includes all the wrong sort of people for a hot story with a political hook. First of all, pretty much everyone involved in the shooting was black. There were rival gangs mixing it up at the festival. The cops even knew about it in advance because people were tipping them off about the gang presence. They had come and told the festival organizers they should shut down early because trouble was brewing. That's what they were trying to do when the fireworks started. The weapons of choice were almost entirely handguns, so there's no chance to rail against banning assault rifles. It was gang warfare. It's probably the most common form of violence seen in cities day in and day out in this country. But nobody talks about it the way they do if a deranged white guy with a rifle commits the far more rare mass shooting of that type. There's a gun violence problem in America that ought to be addressed. Places like Baltimore, Maryland, Chicago have municipal leaders who cannot bring themselves to pass harsher laws to put away first-time offenders who commit crimes with guns. They prefer to focus on judicial reform. They want to empty the prisons more quickly and blame the cops. Background checks don't solve this. Enforcing the laws we already have on the books and getting illegal firearms out of the hands of criminals certainly will. But as Jazz Shaw puts it, nobody seems to want to talk about that. The mass shooting that there won't be any marches about, no protests, no demonstrations, and very little coverage in the media.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review. Catch up on previous episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Pazian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson, the guy who should be here but isn't often. Let me say once again thanks to our sponsors, Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Join us next week for another edition of Town Hall Review, the weekend review program from the perspective you can trust.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.